There is an application form in the pack, and we hope that what you've already experienced today will be enough to enthuse you to join us. It's only £10 a year, but it puts you in touch with a community of people who's not just a community of people based at St Mark's, but as you will observe from where people have come from, South Glamorgan and Surrey as Cumbria, is spread throughout the country and joined together by our common pursuit of liberal stroke, progressive stroke, radical ways of following Jesus. So do that, but not until you've listened to the second part of what Rowan has to say.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for coming back after lunch, which is always the acid test on a day like this. And I shall endeavour to keep you awake in what is notoriously one of the hardest times of day to keep awake. But let me begin, not with a recap, because I hope you might still remember one or two things from this morning, but with something which seems to me to say in much more eloquent ways the most important things I wanted to highlight this morning. I'm quoting here from Archbishop Anthony Bloom, whose writings and presence will be known to many of you, and who for me was one of the most important spiritual influences in my life. This is from something that Archbishop Anthony delivered to seminarians in Moscow, not long after the old Soviet Union had sort of opened up again to Christianity. He gave a series of short talks to these seminarians with the forbidding title, Certain Categories of Our Existence in Creation, which really doesn't give you any clue as to what the talks are really about. Essentially, they're about what to do and how to do it and, you know, being Christian. But here's a couple of paragraphs just to frame once again what I want to say this afternoon and to frame it in the context of a very remarkable, if not unique, person. I did say this morning that I was going to be concentrating a bit this afternoon on the stories, on the actual fleshing out of some of this. And Father Anthony is not a bad place to start. But anyway, this is what he writes. As I said earlier, any knowledge of God is at the same time a greater understanding of humanity. Call to mind the hymn of the Transfiguration, in which it is said that Christ revealed his glory to his disciples as far as they were able to bear it. That is, as much as they could understand, they understood. They saw as much as they could see. They carried away as much as they could. They had seen a vision of God's glory. Here we are given a measure of what humanity is capable of. Not only a measure of limitation, but also a revelation of our possibilities. Every time we meet with this question, it seems to us that the limits have been underlined. Thou canst not see my face and live. But the Apostle Paul says that the time will come when we will see face to face. We will know as we are known, and so on. And we very rarely notice or emphasize that although it's too soon for us to stand face to face, in the meantime we can see something. And how much there is that we can see, how much there is that we can get to know. There are certain things which are incomprehensible by their very nature, but which we can grasp to a certain extent. In the world of the senses, we cannot grasp light. We do not see light. We are surrounded by light. Light shows us what surrounds us, but we do not see or grasp light itself. The same can be said to a certain extent of our knowledge of God. I find those words profound in all sorts of ways. A reminder that what we say about God, we are actually saying also about humanity. That telling the truth about God entails telling the truth about humanity, that the discovery of an understanding of God helps us understand ourselves, and the other way around. But above all, that wonderful comparison of God and light, not what we see, but what we see by or with or in. And That's why I think we can reasonably say, yes, we can make truthful statements about God and never final statements about God. But that's really just by way of, as I say, setting a scene for this afternoon. Because what I'd like to do in the time available this afternoon is discuss a bit more what it means to approach these questions through narratives, the stories of particular people. I hope it won't just be anecdotal, you know, these are people I find interesting, but I'll try and draw out some of the, what I think are the governing themes in these lives of radical faith. I'll begin, though, with a story that's not actually the story of a particular person, a particular actual person, but a fictional story. I hope that a lot of you have read some of the novels of Marilynne Robinson. And her new novel, Lila, just out, hot off the press, is the third of the sequence which began with the novel called Gilead. For those who don't know Marilynne Robinson's work, these are novels which are set in a nondescript little town in the American Midwest, Gilead. And they're novels set roughly in the late 40s, mid-50s of the last century. And they're about a couple of families, a couple of clergy families in this little town. They've been praised on all sides for their beautifully spare and economical painting of scenes and events, the vividly sympathetic evocation of the personalities involved, and the way in which, unfussily and unself-consciously, profound religious and metaphysical themes are quietly introduced and allowed to make their impact. When Gilead was published, a number of people said that it was extraordinary that a novel about a 70-year-old Congregationalist minister in the Midwest could become a bestseller. But that first novel was a very, very gentle depiction of this old man, John Ames, who's been a minister in this town for decades. To his own and everybody else's surprise, he's married for the second time very late in life, an extraordinary, unusual woman called Lila, and they've had a son. Ames is aware that he's not got long to live, and he writes down some of his recollections aimed at his son. The second novel, called Home, is about another clerical family in the same village, the Boughtons, whose son is John Ames' godson. That's a story more riddled with conflict and unease. Boughton, the other minister, Presbyterian, not Congregationalist, is a less serene, a less finished character than John Ames, and we see something of the conflicts, even the torments of his family life, the divisions that arise. But it has something of the same overall serenity as Gilead. But in both those books, the figure of Lila, the young wife of John Ames, is a very enigmatic presence. We learn that she's come from no one quite knows where, with very little education. She's come from a rather wild background, evidently. She doesn't know how to speak properly and conduct herself properly. And yet, the minister has married her. And as we meet her in those first two novels, she is somebody who is constantly coming in at an angle to the benign ramblings of the two old clergy, asking the awkward questions that they'd rather weren't asked. We learn that when she first comes to the town, she goes to John Ames's church one Sunday morning, and he, seeing this unexpected face in the congregation, feels mysteriously that she is, if not judging the words he speaks, at least making him realize that the smooth words pouring out from the pulpit aren't quite connecting with this person from another universe. And yet, gradually, not so gradually, he falls in love with her and tries to help her, embarrassedly, not really willing to admit how much in love he is, until eventually he asks her, "So, what can I do to help you?" And she says, "Well, I think you might marry me." It's a wonderful, wonderful romantic moment. But anyway, in this third novel, Lila, we learn about Lila herself. And I wanted to say a few words about the novel to get us into this afternoon's discussion, because I found it a very, very remarkable way in to thinking about how faith happens or how understanding is learned. And we see here, of course, Lila's own history, her background, an abandoned child taken up by a youngish woman whom she only knows as Doll. She doesn't know her surname or anything. Doll finding Lila abandoned by her own family, adopts her, in effect. But Doll is a drifter. She goes from place to place in the late days of the Depression in America, looking for work where she can find it. They travel with a group of, well, socially marginal people with great problems of all kinds. All that Lila knows is going from place to place, casual labor, prejudice, rejection from many people, and yet the extraordinary loyalty of those around her, rough and disreputable as they are. But as things turn out, she's separated eventually from Doll. She's left pretty well on her own. She works for a while in a brothel. She leaves there, ends up, for no particular reason, in the Midwest, in Gilead, and the story unfurls. So we see her as someone who has absolutely no hinterland, no background of faith. She has no language even for herself. She barely knows the country she's in. We hear that when she has just a few months briefly at school during her childhood, she learns for the first time of the existence of the United States of America. And among other things, this is a very vivid, painfully vivid portrait of the privation and suffering of the Depression period for hundreds of thousands of migrant workers within the United States in those years. So when she gets to Gilead and discovers for the first time this new planet in which people go to church and buy new clothes and converse with each other about things other than the next job and the last place they spent the night, when she discovers this is a place where ordinary civility and kindness are taken for granted, where people want to give her things, she's baffled and intrigued, but still can't quite connect. And she knows in her heart of hearts that there's something which this wonderfully kind and gentle and civilized world of Gilead doesn't know, which she knows. And part of the interest of the novel is how she, this wild outsider, both challenges the life of comfortable Gilead and is challenged by it. She walks away from the church having borrowed a Bible to read. She's never read the Bible before. She ends up reading the prophecy of Ezekiel. So, a bit of Marilyn Robinson on Ezekiel. She'd bathed and waked the second time as she warmed herself in her blanket, thinking about things. And when there was light enough, she took her tablet into her lap and opened her Bible beside her on the floor. She wrote, she's copying from the Bible, "And I looked, and behold, a stormy wind came out of the north, a great cloud with a fire enfolding itself, and a brightness round about it, and out of the midst thereof, as it were, glowing metal out of the midst of the fire." Well, that could have been a prairie fire in a drought year. She'd never seen one, but she'd heard stories. "And out of the midst thereof came the likeness of four living creatures, and this was their appearance. They had the likeness of a man, and every one had four faces, and every one of them had four wings." Well, she didn't know what to make of that. A dream somebody had, and he wrote it down, and it ended up in this book. She copied it 10 times, still trying to make her letters smaller and neater. Her name had the likeness of a name. She had the likeness of a woman, with hands but no face at all, since she never let herself see it. She had the likeness of a life, because she was all alone in it. She lived in the likeness of a house, with walls and a roof and a door that kept nothing in and nothing out. She thought, strange as all this is, there might be something to it. What Lilo discovers in reading these wild words from Ezekiel is a kind of recognition. Her own sense, as it says later on, her own sense of the wildness of things is somehow reflected back to her in the pages of Scripture. And the beginnings of her faith, stroke understanding, are not at all in grasping the doctrine that the minister is trying to put across to her. She's trying to make sense of the feeling of recognition that has arisen as she reads these passages of Scripture. And to me, that's one of the most fascinating and challenging aspects of this truly wonderful novel. It's about recognizing that you have been recognized, and faith coming alive when you recognize that you have been recognized. And that makes me think a lot about the language we use and how we use it in a Christian community, and how many obstacles we put up in churches to people feeling that they've been recognized. How many people come into Christian communities and feel that their humanity has not been recognized. They can't recognize that they've been recognized. Lila finds trouble enough with the local church. She wants to be baptized, she decides, and then finds she can't really understand a word of the baptism preparation. She says that to the minister, and John Ames, because he loves her, says, "I don't care whether you understand or not, do you want it?" And she says, "Yes." And then, a little bit later, she hears John Ames and his friend, the Presbyterian minister, talking about grace and predestination in a sort of amiable academic way. And she realizes that the way they're talking, most of the people who've mattered most in her life are probably going to go to hell. And she thinks, "I must undo my baptism. I can't be separated from them." And she goes to the river and washes herself to wash off her baptism, because she feels, "I can't be separate from these people who have made me who I am." And it's only when her child is born and the child is baptized that she, very privately, very quietly, allows her husband to touch her forehead 3 times with a wet palm. And you realize something's happened, something's shifted, and she's no longer thinking of being separate. Baptism has stopped being something that separates. It's become something that unites. And she expresses it at the end, the last few pages of this novel, which are really a leisurely meditation by Lila on grace and God and heaven. So here she is thinking. The old coat he'd put over her shoulders when they were walking in the evening was as good to remember as the time Doll took her up in her arms. She thought it was nothing she had known to hope for and something she'd wanted too much all the same. Too much happiness came with it, and happiness was strange to her. He said, "We have to keep you with us." In that eternity of his, Ames, where everybody will be happy, how could he feel the lack of her, the loss of her? She had to think about that. Sometimes she'd ask him about it. It must always be true that there are the stragglers, people somebody couldn't bear to be without, no matter what they've been up to in this life. And then there were the people no one would miss, who'd done no special harm, who just lived and died as well as they could manage. That would have been her if she'd not wandered into Gilead. And then she thought, "I couldn't bear to be without Doll or Melly or Doan and Marcel. Even Arthur and his boys, not that they'd mattered so much to her when she was a child, but because fair was fair, and none of them ever had any good thing that the others didn't have some right to. If there was goodness at the center of things, that one rule would have to be respected, because it was as important to them as anything in this world." Can a soul in bliss feel a weight lift off his heart? She couldn't help imagining. Oh, here you are. Your dear weariness and ugliness as beautiful as light. That boy weeping over what he was, his big dirty hands that had done something he couldn't quite believe, and then there he would be, shocked at the kindness all around him, which was the last thing he'd expected. It couldn't matter much how life seemed. The old man always said we should attend to the things we have some hope of understanding, and eternity isn't one of them. Well, this world isn't one either. Most of the time she thought she understood things better when she didn't try. Things happen the way they do. Why was a foolish question. In a song, a note follows a note. Because it's that song and not another one. That's what she was thinking. The Reverend couldn't bear to be without her. She couldn't bear to be without them. It was eternity that let her think like that without a bit of shame. There was no end to it. Thank God, as the old man would say. Now there's what I think is a really extraordinary evocation of what it means to think things in the light of God. Lila doesn't have much of a concept of God. Thank God, as the old men say, whatever that means. But somehow, there is a light, there is a perspective around her that allows her to think, what if heaven is about the people we can't bear to be without? What if it's true of every single soul that there's somebody who can't bear to be without them? Well, that surely is grace. That's heaven. That's part of what God makes it possible to think and feel and have faith in. And that's why I find this book of such interest. It's about faith and understanding. You could say it's about faith in search of understanding. It's about how imperceptibly, eccentrically, and very bumpily, a kind of trust grows that what is seen in the light of this rather difficult language about God, what is seen is that picture of a world in which no one is abandoned, because there is always someone who can't bear to be without you. So, a story of faith, and I think you'll see that it has some bearing on some of what we've been thinking about already today. Lila is learning a way of being, a way of speaking. She's learning, literally, how to write and speak in a new way after her profoundly deprived childhood and young adulthood. She's not mastering a complete, satisfactory set of propositions about God, but the things she's doing and the things being done with and to her are allowing her to feel the grain of reality differently. Please read it. And in a sense, if you do nothing else this afternoon than register the fact that what's-his-name mentioned the name of Marilyn Robinson and you ought to read that book, that's fine by me. Now, that's an illustration, I think, of what I meant this morning by saying we need a calendar not of saints, but of, let's not say sinners, but strugglers. A calendar of people whose journeys tell us something about the nature of faith, whose stories tell us what sort of thing faith is. And so I want to touch on two or three lives which, for me, matter in this way, from very different backgrounds indeed. And the first of these is, you perhaps won't be surprised to hear, Thomas Merton. Merton, for people of my generation, certainly was an immensely important Christian writer. I discovered him first, I suppose, when I was about 15, and read him voraciously for the next 15 years, pretty regularly, less regularly after that, and then returning to him again in the last 10 years or so. What makes him a very unusual writer is, of course, that he is somebody with a colossally developed, sophisticated 20th century literary cultural sensitivity, who becomes a Trappist monk, and who tries very, very hard, for the first few years of being a monk, to be a good monk, fails conspicuously to our great profit, and goes back to being a writer, but a writer who is the kind of writer he is because he's also a Trappist monk. His struggles with monastic authority, his passionate desire to be a hermit, and his passionate desire when he was a hermit to have lots of company, and an unparalleled number of correspondents all around the world. All of this is part of what I mean by saying he's the writer he is, because he's also a Trappist monk. And he's both a very good and a very bad monk because of this tremendous sensitivity to the cultural environment he inhabits. And his is a story with two or three major shifts and moments of growth, discoveries of faith. His first really successful book was, of course, his autobiography, The Seven-Story Mountain, a reference to the mountain of purgatory. It's an autobiography which begins in 1915, it's his centenary next year, which details his unhappy childhood, unhappy and rootless childhood, his extremely unhappy period as a student at Cambridge, his much happier but rather chaotic period as a student in New York, his wildly rackety lifestyle as an undergraduate and a graduate student, his recognition that this wasn't getting anywhere, and his conversion to Roman Catholicism at the age of about 26. What we then see is a period of serious upheaval in his life. He's become a Roman Catholic, and he's very serious about it, and he's increasingly persuaded that he ought to become a priest, or perhaps a monk. He makes overtures to the Franciscan friars and is accepted as a postulant for the Franciscan order. He realizes in retrospect that that's really another kind of theater for him. He loves the idea of being a Franciscan friar, wearing a nice brown robe and trotting around in sandals and a cord round his waist. Very picturesque. And he realizes that that can't be quite right. He decides to tell the Franciscan superiors a bit more about his background, including the fact that he fathered an illegitimate child when he was an undergraduate at Cambridge. The Franciscan authorities back off, and Merton is left stranded. A second moment of transition, a moment of truth. Suddenly, the theater of faith, the apparently very consoling environment in which you can play a satisfying role as a religious person, somehow that seems rather hollow. He makes a retreat at the Trappist monastery in Kentucky, and after quite a bit of struggle decides that's where he needs to be, because that's a total abandonment of all the things that have compromised him and enslaved him and held him back. So he plunges in at the deep end. He becomes a Trappist. The Trappists are much less worried, it seems, about people's disreputable histories than the Franciscans are. I don't know. Perhaps they've changed since. As a young monk, he does what he can to be the perfect young monk. He sends away his poetry notebooks and his fiction notebooks. He decides to lead a life as exemplary and pure as possible as a monk. And not surprisingly, after a few years, finds that this is not only boring, but it's making him ill, physically and mentally ill. He's in a very successful, large, buzzing, busy monastery, in spite of the silence. It's noisy with the industrial machinery that the monks use in the fields. It's noisy with the rebuilding projects in the monastery. He decides the answer is to become a hermit. And gradually, over the years, he gets permission to spend more time on his own, and eventually has a hermitage in the woods that is just for him. He promptly fills it up with his friends who visit from all over America and the rest of the world, writes more than ever, and in 1966 falls in love with a student nurse in a hospital in the nearby town. The journal that describes the months of that love affair are very, very poignant reading. He recognizes at one and the same time that his sexuality, which was so lavishly indulged in his younger days, has never really been resolved for him. He's just firmly closed down that side of himself, and all those emotions are taking their revenge, as it were. At the same time, he realizes that his commitment to the celibate life and the monastic life is something that he can't do anything about. It's there, it's real. And the journal records real torment, real inner struggle over this. It all ends, not very happily. He has permission from his abbot to go and visit monasteries in the Far East and take part in a conference of Buddhist and Catholic monks in the Far East. He goes and has a fatal accident and is electrocuted in his hotel room in December 1968. But that last trip, recorded in his Asian journal, shows him with his eyes being opened more and more to a mysterious presence of there-ness that the great Buddhist images of India and Sri Lanka convey to him. And his meeting with the Dalai Lama on this trip speaks of the same thing. He's a Catholic Christian. He doesn't want to be a Buddhist. But more and more says, the only way I can go on being a Catholic Christian is with what I've learned from Buddhism. So there we are. A life with any number of transitions and discoveries. A life in which faith comes alive in such radically and surprisingly different ways. And Merton's somebody I'd like to have in the calendar of strugglers rather than saints. Not because I don't think he was a holy man in some respects, but because what matters about him is that constant willingness to be stretched. Time and again, there is an image that he sets up. He wants to be a Franciscan friar. He wants to be a perfect, silent, faceless Trappist monk. He wants to be a hermit. He wants to be in love. And image after image is broken and crumpled and grown through. And at the very end, faced with the immense and still there-ness of the religious images he sees in Asia, there's a kind of breakthrough. And by some incalculable providence, he dies. It's that sense of picture after picture being broken through that matters there. Comforting religious pictures, pleasant religious systems. All the way through, he is, at root, an ordinary, orthodox, practicing Roman Catholic. He doesn't, so to speak, mess around with the details of doctrine. He goes to Mass, he takes Holy Communion, he makes his meditations, he says the Rosary. And yet, something constantly stops him settling with the picture, the role, the theatre of it, and keeps him moving. And that's why, for me, he is one of those great heroes of faith in this sense. A disposition, as I said this morning, an attitude to the world. Open, risky, and yet not relativistic or indifferent or merely exploratory or self-indulgent. Because every movement forward is deeply painful. Every dissolution of the images hurts. But truth is what you move into. So, yes, I'd like to have Merton in that calendar. And I think his story is one that we as Christian believers ought to think about, not looking to Merton as a sort of exemplar of spiritual wisdom. He wrote wonderful stuff, lots of it. He He also wrote a certain amount of water-treading stuff. It's rather like C.S. Lewis. He's not been very well served by the fact that people have published absolutely everything he ever wrote. And when I think what it would be like to have everything I've ever written published, you know, my heart sinks. Because everybody writes a fair amount of rubbish in their lives, and a fair amount of stuff that's just not very good. C.S. Lewis, whom I hugely admire, unfashionably, some of what he wrote is not very good. And when he's good, he's brilliant. Some of what Merton wrote isn't very good, and the best is indescribably good. So, as a hero, a moving hero, a hero who keeps growing and is stretched by what he sees and knows. But my second figure, again, some of you may just have come across her, even more of a strange story. And this is the Dutch Jewish woman, Etty Hillesum, whose journals were published about 15 years ago. She died in Auschwitz at the age of 27. And what we know of her is simply through her journals and her letters. She wasn't like Merton, a public figure, a writer. Well, she was a writer, certainly, but she had no public face as a writer. And again, actually, it's her centenary this year. Etty Hillesum came from a Jewish family that wasn't particularly religious. Rather like Merton, she had a fairly dramatic early adulthood. We first meet her in her journals, involved in an affair with one much older man and about to start an affair with another one. But the journals describe that period when the Nazis had just arrived in Amsterdam and the net was closing around the Jews of Holland. Etty is aware of her Jewishness, aware that the clouds are gathering, and doesn't at first quite know what to do about it. But as time goes on and she reflects on her vulnerable identity, a Jewish woman in the middle of this environment, she finds that, to her own great surprise, she's being pressed to think more about God. And not just to think more about God. There's a very moving passage where she describes kneeling down in her room. And she says, "I always said I would never kneel. Kneeling is a posture of abasement and humiliation. And here I am kneeling down because I don't know what else to do. I have to make a gesture," she's saying, "towards something. A gesture which involves me, my body. I've got to put my body on the line somehow, in some sense, so that I can speak, I can articulate my sense of a dependence, an adoration, an unpayable, unimaginable debt to reality." And she says, "I don't know whether I'm talking about something that's inside me or out there in the universe. I know I've just got to do it." So she kneels, and her journals record that, you know, day by day, she just kneels. That's it. She hasn't developed a theology. She's not knocking on the door of the local parish priest or the rabbi, but she is moving into a new attitude, a new disposition. She's moving into faith. She's moving into faith. And then, of course, she's arrested. She's rounded up with the other Jewish inhabitants of Amsterdam, and she's sent to the transit camp at Westerbork and put on the train for Auschwitz, where she is killed. In the transit camp, she thinks a bit further about what faith might mean. And what she says is something like this: "This is a world in which it seems God is not there. In a world in which God is not there, somebody's got to behave as if there were a God. And it looks as if it's me," she says. "I've got to live in this environment of profound inhumanity as if there were a God. I have to take responsibility for God, she says. God asking me to be there where he isn't. So I have to live as if. I have to live as if generosity were the bottom line in human relations, as if trust mattered, as if love were real. I have to live in a way that refuses resentment, self-pity, and all the rest of it. She's almost saying, I have to live in such a way as to make up God. And I don't think that's at all irreverent or arrogant or dishonest. She's recognized in her life, in her actions and her words, that there is something to which she is answerable, something for which she must take responsibility in the world. And her journals form a quite exceptional chronicle of a faith which is radically unlike most of what we regard in terms of faith, which never finds conventional expression. She loves Christian writers. She reads St. Augustine and Dostoevsky. She is fascinated by Christian language and imagery. At the same time, she's entirely conscious of her Jewishness and in no hurry to abandon that. And so, what is she growing into? A very strictly minded religious person might say that it's not got very much to do with religious belonging, religious affiliation. Another kind of person might say, well, she's a very good example of spirituality rather than religion. But I think what makes her rather more than that, and what makes her more interesting, is that she's deeply conscious of the fact that her growth into faith is fundamentally about how she is in the world with others. It's not about how she feels. She's deeply conscious of a solidarity which escapes all definition and all institution. And what she believes she's being drawn into is that depth of solidarity beyond choice, beyond preference, beyond will almost, just placed within the human network, charged with honoring the memory, the suspicion that we are all answerable to a love that values all. I just have a suspicion that Marilyn Robinson's Lila and Etty Hillison might have found quite a lot to say to each other. Because what I read in Etty Hillison's work is something very like the Robinsonian perspective or Lila's perspective, that to see things in the light of God is to know somehow that nothing can be spared, nothing can be left out. Thomas Merton and Etty Hillison are, as you see, notably different personalities. Merton remains, for all his radicalism, essentially an insider. And Etty Hillison remains, for all her fascination with the religious world, an outsider. And those are the least important things about them, because what's happening in both those lives is the gradually formed, gradually educated willingness to be led out into perhaps something of the ecstasis, the ecstasy, the standing outside that I talked about in the question session before lunch. The dissolution of easy pictures, the movement into another world, another stance, another set of relations. So, with this one fictional and two actual stories, Lila and Thomas Merton and Etty Hillison, what does this have to say about faith in search of understanding in the light of what we've been talking about and thinking about today generally? It tells us, I think, that crucial to the enterprise of faith is a mixture of recognition and estrangement. We, as I say, we recognize that we have been recognized. We know in some sense, at some level, that we have been known. And in that very fact, we also know that we are more known than we know about, and that therefore who we are is something repeatedly being opened up, and opened up. And faith belongs there. The role of doctrine and formulation in faith is not negligible, it's not nothing. And I wouldn't want to be understood as saying that that has no significance or no meaning. Far from it. When it's doing its job, the formulation of Christian teaching in recognizable continuous ways is something that ought to keep us alert to that basic characteristic of faith. Always more to be said, always more to be discovered, never the object at arm's length. And going back to Archbishop Antony, recognizing that what we say about God grows in pace with what we say and know about ourselves, and vice versa. Because I think we certainly see that in those three stories, in Lila's story, in Thomas Merton's biography, in Etty Hillerson's journals. People who are finding new ways to think about themselves as they discover the language of God. People who, as they grow in self-awareness and depth of human maturity and human relating, discover almost unexpectedly that there are things they can say about God that they never thought they could say. So, if we are talking about faith and understanding, we're not, I think, talking about trying to get, as I said, a better or a more economical or even more coherent account, intellectual account, of what we believe. I think we may be talking about how we believe as part of how we grow, how our self-images and God-images are always going to be challenged and broken open by what grows within them, how understanding, in the sense of a grasp of the mysteriousness of ourselves and God, how that is essential to faith itself. So what I hope we might do in discussion among yourselves and then in questions for the rest of this afternoon's session is perhaps, dare I invite you privately in conversation with one another to share for a few moments lives or narratives that work for you as faith stories. And then see what we can share on the basis of that. I hesitate a bit to use a word like faith story, a phrase like faith story, or even faith journey. We sometimes use it a bit easily, and sometimes it's very tempting to treat faith journeys as simple journeys from unbelief to belief, or not having it straight to getting it straight. And I'm not sure that the stories I've mentioned are quite like that, about moving from not having it straight to getting it straight. But if you'd like to reflect a bit on that, on lives you know of, fictional or real, that help you to see that, I hope that may give a ground on which some discussion might grow afterwards about how we tell such stories and share such stories with that world around us which is less interested in clear, finished, polished products and more interested, I would dare to say, in, well, the dazzling darkness that the poet speaks of, where we discover what we genuinely did not know or know that we could have known. That world, that new world which Lila speaks of at the end of her reflections. Let me just read to finish a last bit of Marilyn Robinson. Lila's thinking about her past, about the murky events she's been involved in, about the tragic events that her friend Doll has been involved in. There was no way to abandon guilt, no decent way to disown it. All the tangles and knots of bitterness and desperation and fear had to be pitied. No, better, grace had to fall over them. Doll, hunched in the firelight, sharpening her courage, thinking terrible thoughts to blunt her own fear. That's how it is. Lila had borne a child into a world where a wind could rise that would take him from her arms as if there were no strength in them at all. Piteous, yes, but we are brave, she thought, and wild. More life in us than we can bear. More life in us than we can bear. The fire enfolding itself in us. That peace could only be amazement, too. Well, for now, there were geraniums in the windows and an old man at the kitchen table telling his baby some rhyme he'd known forever, probably still wondering if he'd managed to bring her along into that next life, if he could ever be certain of it, almost letting himself imagine grieving for her in heaven, because not to grieve for her would mean he was dead after all. Someday, she would tell him what she knew.
Our programme has a 10-minute little comfort break here, but I suggest that what we do is we spend that time doing exactly what Rowan's asked us to do, which is talking to people, thinking about what we've heard, coming up with our own stories that have inspired us. Clearly, if you want to go to the loo, this is the time to do it. But we'll have some questions and answers in about 10 minutes' time.